hanging over a nylon tree. But it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me. Without your smile, it's a honky-tonk parade. Without your love, it's a melody played in a penny arcade. It's a Barnum and Bailey world, phony as it can be. But it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me.
It's Only a Paper Moon, sung by lyricist Yip Harburg. Harburg wrote the lyric with Billy Rose. Harold Arlen wrote the music. This is WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Yip Harburg gave us lots of great songs, including Brother Can You Spare a Dime, Over the Rainbow, April in Paris, and, for Groucho Marx, Lydia, the Tattooed Lady. Today on the afternoon magazine, American Popular Music, we welcome your questions and comments about great singers and songwriters. Our guest is writer and singer Gene Lees. He's the author of several books on jazz and American popular music and its origins. He's also the publisher of Gene Lees' Jazz Letter. Gene Lees recently revised his classic book, Singers and the Song, the new title, Singers and the Song 2. The publisher is Oxford. Join the conversation with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Outside Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Gene Lees, good afternoon. Welcome.
Hi there. Nice to be with you.
Would you like to comment on Yip Harburg's treatment of...
Well, first of all, I've never heard... I knew Yip slightly, not well, but I did know him. Being a much younger songwriter, I was fascinated by that generation that I admired. And my work through... Johnny Mercer introduced me to Yip Harburg. And I got to know a lot of those people who are all gone now. And Yip Harburg was an astonishing lyricist. He was Mercer's great hero and one of mine. He had a technical command of the use of the language that surpassed, I would say, just about anybody except Mercer and Howard Dietz. He wrote magnificent stuff, and that lyric you just played on there, where was that done, at the YMHA in New York?
Yes.
Yeah, because there was lyricists and lyrics, songs and songwriters, whatever it was called, that they did a very valuable series. And I've never heard that version of the lyric. There's several.
Really?
Well, there's several major deviations from the one that the public generally knows. Nat Cole saying, "It is only a canvas sky hanging over a muslin tree." He's saying on there, if you notice, it's only a cotton sky hanging over a nylon tree. And the other thing was, it's in the release, Nat Cole saying, "Without your love, it's a honky-tonk parade." And he's just saying, "Without your smile, it's a honky-tonk parade." It's a totally new light on that lyric that I've never heard before. Mm.
Also, it seems to me that when we hear that tune, It's Only a Paper Moon, it's much more up-tempo.
Usually.
And here, it's much more ballad-like.
Yeah, well, probably I would make a guess on that. Yip wasn't really a singer. He wasn't an experienced singer like Johnny Mercer, for example. And he may have found handling an up-tempo version of a thing would be quite difficult. That takes a pretty well-developed professional skill. Mm. Livingston and Evans, Jay Livingston and Ray Evans, another lyric writing team, are friends of mine, and I've heard them do their work, and they always do it slow because I don't think they know how to do it fast. I think they're a little frightened of the tension of doing it up-tempo. But you're quite right. It's usually done much faster.
Yeah. He gave Dorothy her rainbow.
Yep.
Want to tell us about that?
But Over the Rainbow?
Yeah.
That song, well, of course, he wrote that with Harold Arlen for The Wizard of Oz, and it's one of those situations, there's quite a number of these things historically. That song was almost left out of the picture, and it may be one of the two or three greatest motion picture scores that was, for song scores that were ever written. And that's a wonderful score. We're off to see the Wizard, the Wonderful Wizard of Oz.
Mm-hmm.
And Yip was a very political man. in the sense of his dedication to this country and his sense of its freedoms, and his songs like The Eagle and Me, which is about freedom, and his anti-racism stand in various of his musicals. He was an altogether magnificent man.
Yeah. Well, his lyrics run from Brother, Can You Spare a Dime?
Yeah, that's another one about the Depression.
And The Begat from Finian's
yep.
Rainbow
yep.
to Lydia the Tattooed Lady.
Yep. By a weird coincidence, this afternoon after we finish, I'm going into Los Angeles, because I live in Ojai, California. I'm going to Los Angeles, and the guy I got to meet this afternoon is a man named Larry Orenstein, who was Yip's friend, and who played, he was understudy to David Wayne in Finian's Rainbow.
Wow.
Anyway, there's quite a history there. He was a marvelous man. I met him, he lived in an apartment up on Central Park West in New York.
Yet, I suspect for many, his name is unfamiliar.
Well, there's a book out about him, a biography, and there's an extensive chapter in the revised version of My Singers and the Song on Yip. I was quite a student of his work.
Mm-hmm. There's an essay in your book, Singers and the Song, on Harburg, and you tell readers that Harburg saw the relative anonymity of lyricists as a small injustice.
Yeah, he called it that. Johnny Mercer felt it, and I, as a lyricist, have often felt it too. You'll hear there's a famous story about that. There's various versions of it, but supposedly Oscar Hammerstein's wife was at some dinner party, and they said something about. There's various versions of it, but it goes like this. Somebody said about Mr. Jerome Kern wrote The Old Man River, and she says, oh, I beg your pardon, Mr. Kern wrote da, 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 da. My husband wrote Old Man River. And it is a small injustice. Yip was quite right about that. The composer is usually far more noticed.
Yeah.
Except Mercer. Mercer was the most publicly visible lyricist of them all.
Yeah. Now, you agree with Yip Harburg in that the two of you, and probably others, have a feeling that music preceded speech. And I think that that's something that maybe you'd like to explore with us here this afternoon. I think that's really interesting to think about. I'll paraphrase Yip Harburg. Here, words offer meaning, the music a feeling.
I'll give you an exact illustration of what I mean. I used it in one of my other books. Everybody knows this, or has heard, even if only in dumb situations in movies, the French expression, ooh la la. Actually, they're more inclined to say, oh la la. But they can convey, in a totally meaningless phrase, they can convey an incredible amount of subtlety in it. And even if you don't speak French, you're going to get the point of this exactly. Well, and I'll give you an illustration of what I mean. If you go to your mechanic, and he lifts the hood of your car, and he looks in and says, oh la la. You know you've got a very... You don't have to speak French to know you're in a lot of trouble. And if you hear a little kid say, oh la la, it's all the shift of the pitch. Conveys, that's like, oh, it's like a new bicycle for Christmas or something.
Yeah.
And the oh la la is very, very sensual and, erotic even. And the French do use that expression, but they use it with an incredible number of nuances of meaning. And one of the things I use in one of my books, you could take a simple phrase of the English language, like put it back, and the nature of the communication is entirely in the musical pitch. If you say, put it back, meaning this has happened so many times before, and if you say, put it back, it's like I caught you with your hand in a cookie jar, and if you say it all on the same note, put it back, it's ominous and threatening. The entire nuance of what you're conveying in there is in the melody, and it is usually said that Chinese is one of what are called tonal languages. The same words can have totally different meanings in depending on the pitch of the voice and the pitch of the melody of the voice, as it were, in Chinese. But I insist that English is, all languages are essentially tonal. Some of the Oriental languages are merely more so. But why I hate all the rock and roll lyrics and think they're all garbage is simply they do not match, not all, I shouldn't say that because there's some of them I like. But what has happened since the age of Yip Harburg, where songwriting has gone downhill, is the failure to match melody to speech inflection. And I'll show you what I mean by that. When Lerner and Lowe did My Fair Lady, the final scene in this musical, as you know, comes when, at the very end, Professor Higgins is sitting there in his chair and Liza has left. And she turns up in the doorway, but he doesn't see her. And he sits there musing and he says, I've grown accustomed to her face. Mm. And this is exactly what, and she knows he loves her by just that. But what it was done was melodies, da 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 dee 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 da, which is, I've grown accustomed to her face, which is the way you'd say it. So there's a perfect match of speech inflection to musical inflection in that. And if you fooled around with that scene, if some singer decided to take it upon himself to say, I've grown accustomed to her face, and change it, you destroy the song.
Yeah.
If you destroy the song at that point in the play, you destroy the scene. If you destroy the scene, you destroy the entire musical. And the entire structure of that play hangs on those few notes.
Mm.
And it's the flawless match of speech inflection to musical inflection that makes that song work.
Yeah.
People like Mercer and Yip Harburg were highly, highly sensitive to the close relationship between speech intervals and musical intervals. I was in a Chinese restaurant one day, and the husband and wife were having an argument in the kitchen. I didn't understand a single word they were saying, but I sure understood the emotion just by the shift of melodic pitch in the
mm-hmm.
voice. And so I think what Yip meant, and I think what I believe is true, if you listen to cats or listen to dogs, or listen to birds too, for that matter, but if you listen to them, there's melodic inflections in the noises they make. And you can get the emotion of whether a dog is frightened or whether it's excited or what have you entirely by the bark. And I think those communications of animals in nature is the true foundation of first music and second speech. I think speech grows out of music, not vice versa.
Yeah. Well, if you have a child, a baby, that is learning to make sounds, or that,
yep.
you know, before the words come, if that child is engaged in a household
yeah.
with people, the baby might not be saying words, but that the cooing and, you know, there will be sounds of delight, and it's very musical.
There's a lot of new research going on how babies learn to speak, and it's sort of radicalizing what we think about it. You're absolutely correct about that. I mean, a baby communicates to its mother its emotions, its needs, all by musical pitches. And, of course, the texture and sound, but that's the same thing that singing's all about.
Mm.
This is what Sinatra's a genius at, is putting a sort of vocal, emotional... It's like great acting. You do it with facial expression if it's visible acting, but you do it also by sound. And Sinatra's a genius in attaching the real emotion to that lyric by what's going on in his throat.
Mm. We've got a caller waiting to talk with us
okay.
on line one in Urbana. Our guest this afternoon, Gene Lees. Caller in Urbana, you're on the air. Hi.
Yeah. The Fram Fram Sauce, you know, I thought was a Johnny Mercer lyric.
No, it's not.
But I know it's not. And
Cute and It's Charming. Have you heard there's a new recording on that by Diana Krall?
Yeah, I know.
It's cute, charming.
I know, and actually is equally as good as Rebecca Kilgore in Portland.
Uh-huh.
Now I'm going to open up a kettle of worms for you.
Fine.
Tunesmith lyricist Irving Berlin, Cole Porter.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they wrote the tunes.
And they wrote music and lyrics.
Absolutely.
So does Dave Frischberg.
I know, man. I got you.
So did Mercer, by the way. He was just always in demand as a lyricist, and for the record, so do I, but I usually get called on for lyrics.
Well,
Berlin was one of the great natural melodists and songwriters of all time, one of the great masters. No question.
Right. Well, I mean, are you going to address that? I mean, look what he did, you know.
Yeah, I've looked at it.
And look what Cole Porter did.
I've done documentaries on both of them.
All right, I'm going to hang up and let you address
No, you don't have to hang up if you want to. But these are masters. I happen to think, and I was Johnny Mandel is one of the great, great master songwriters of this period of time.
Is he a master songwriter?
Well, he's a certain melody writer.
He is, really.
Yeah, magnificent melody writer.
Shadow of Your Smile and...
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
Shadow of Your Smile, there's a stack of them, and he's a marvelous melody writer, privately among musicians.
Not to mention a terrific arranger.
and a sensation. As a matter of fact, I'm on my way into town. I got to see Larry Orenstein and Johnny Mandel this afternoon.
And you're in Ojai.
Yeah. Which is up the coast near Santa Barbara.
I know. I've been there.
By God, it's very unusual.
I envy you.
Little tiny town.
Yeah. The Ojai Inn.
Yep.
I got you.
I was with Mandel last week. We spent the day with Red Norvo, and we went in to see him. He's in a wheelchair in a nursing home, and we went into
him. Oh, man.
Yeah. And I'm going to see him again this week.
Great vibes player.
Wonderful musician. But Johnny and I were talking about lyrics and lyric writing and this, that, and the other, and I said, John, there's a whole bunch of opinions and nuances you get into. Mercer, in the opinion of Paul Weston, in the opinion of every lyricist I know, was the greatest lyricist in the history of American song, or maybe the history of the whole English language.
I won't disagree with that.
But the thing about it is, I said to Johnny, as I wrote a book on the technique of lyric writing, and I said, Johnny, I've examined the entire English language. I know the entire rhyming pattern of the whole language by memory.
Right.
And I said, but technically, the greatest lyricist I have ever heard in the English language is Howard Dietz.
Oh.
Technically, I'm not saying Mercer had a bigger range, emotionally.
I understand.
But in terms of the skill in the use of the language, there's that marvelous thing he wrote, Arthur Schwartz.
Dancing
was his partner,
in the Dark.
Dancing in the Dark. But when he wrote that, Arthur Schwartz told me that he wrote, I think there's about 5 choruses of lyric to That's Entertainment. And there's, what, for example, and Arthur told me he wrote those whole 5 choruses in about an hour.
Well, sure.
And
that's what they do.
Some do. No, Mercer took a year on Skylark.
Well, Skylark. You know.
But he also wrote. Johnny.
Did he write the words to Skylark?
Pardon me?
No, he didn't. Wasn't
Mercer did Skylark. It's Hoagy Carmichael's tune. Yeah.
Wasn't that Mitch Parrish?
Nope. It was Johnny. Hoagy were going to do a musical for Broadway based on Young Man with a Horn, and therefore the music is meant to sound like Bix. And that's the very character of that melody. But Johnny told me it took a long time to do that lyric. But he wrote the lyric for The Autumn Leaves. Autumn Leaves. He wrote up that in about 15 minutes. So it's like Johnny said when we were talking about that. He says sometimes you get lucky. There's a chapter on Mercer in my book too.
Yeah, I want to thank the caller for his call this afternoon and invite others to join us as well. Here are the numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. If you're listening outside Champaign-Urbana, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest is Gene Lees. He's the author of several books on jazz and American popular music and its origins. He's also the publisher of Gene Lees' Jazz Letter and a lyricist. His classic book, Singers and the Song, has been recently revised. The new title, Singers and the Song, too. The publisher is Oxford. My name is Celeste Quinn. Again, your calls are welcome this afternoon, 333-9455. Toll free, 1-800-222-9455. I would like to talk with you about a singer-songwriter who, as a rock and roll child, I loved. She was born in North Dakota, and you have a chapter devoted to her in your book. Her name, Norma Dolores Eggstrom, that was her name at birth. And I thought here we'd hear a recording of hers from 1952.
I used to love to hold you when the lights were down low, but it's all over now. You used to whisper little things to set me aglow, but it's all over now. I listen to you tell me little white lies, never thought you meant to deceive. Whoever would have doubted those innocent eyes and all the little kisses that you made me believe. Remember how I planned a little home by a stream where we'd spend every day. You must have thought me crazy when I painted that dream, 'cause you threw it away. I kinda wish that things would be different, have a happy ending somehow. But I guess you only took me for a ride in the dark, and it's all over now.
Norma Dolores Eggstrom, Miss Peggy Lee.
Celeste, this record baffles me. It doesn't sound like her.
Yeah?
Take a look at the label.
Well, let me see. Well, that's what it says on the label.
What label? What record company is it?
It's Time Life MCA.
I think they've made a mistake.
Oh,
I don't think that's
goodness.
Peggy.
You know, I kind of wondered about it because I think Peggy Lee is huskier.
Yeah, she is. Her voice is slower. It's richer. It's deeper. And she's got better time than this singer.
Well, I've been
and Peg's
had.
One of believe me, like knowing your mother's voice on the
yeah.
telephone. Peg's one of my best friends, and that doesn't sound like her to me.
Yeah.
I got to know about that record, Time Life.
Yeah,
what's the album called?
It's called Your Hit Parade, the 40s.
And what year was it?
What year was the record? It said the recording was 1952, and, 1946.
Well, then that might be Peg.
1946.
It's a very, very youthful sound.
Because when I
got to find out about this.
Yeah, let me.
I'm going to call her and ask her.
1946 Capitol, and that's when she was with Capitol.
Yeah, when she was Capitol, no question about it.
And let me see if I can find. Now it doesn't give us really any more information.
That doesn't. It's not that
no.
significant. But if it is, it could be her when she was very, very young. But I mean, I'm familiar with her work from the time she was with Benny Goodman in the early 40s.
Hmm.
And it just doesn't sound like her. It's very atypical if that's her.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, I wonder what the story is there.
I don't know. I'm going to call her and ask her.
Well, please, also, would you just tell her that I love her work?
Sure will. So do I. Mandela and I were talking about that the other day. My two favorite living, well, she's pretty well retired now, but there's a couple of singers I'm absolutely batty about. She's one of them, and Shirley Horn is another.
Oh, Shirley Horn is delightful. And I
yep.
think this afternoon, we won't have time to play a Shirley Horn piece in this portion of the program, but later this afternoon I'll get one in because I brought in a Shirley Horn CD.
I think it's her last album. She just recorded one of mine, and I was just knocked out to hear it. It's one of the things I did with Joe Beam. It's called Someone to Light Up My Life. She just recorded that.
Oh, I'll have to look for that. Let's talk a little bit about Peggy Lee. Although this it sounded like a very young recording of her.
It could be. If it is, she's very, very young.
It is, yeah. But, you know, her voice, I think, or her material we're more familiar with is like Fever.
Yep, that's later on. That's in the
50s. And then even later than that, Is That All There Is?
Yeah, that's much later.
Yeah. How did she come to her style, that powerful, dramatic, minimal style?
Minimal, absolutely right. As I mentioned in the essay, I was over at visiting her at her home maybe a year or two ago, whatever it was, and she wanted me to see a couple of her old television shows, and one of them, she's standing there in a snow white dress, long evening dress, and just singing the song and almost motionless. And I said to her, Peg, where do you find the courage to do nothing?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, instead of jumping around the stage and trying to get attention with your hands and all that stuff, I said, where do you get the courage to do absolutely nothing? And she thought about it for a minute, and she said, there is power in stillness. And some of that came from when she did some studies with Nick Castle, the choreographer. And he said, no, don't move too much. Just concentrate on the song. And what she does is concentrates totally on the meaning of the song, rather than physical gesture or any of that. Sure, she makes an occasional gesture. But she's a very still performer. And I've never seen anybody quite like her, and I've seen her countless times in person.
Mm.
And she has that quality of what I was mentioning earlier, of getting the emotion of the song into the sound of the voice itself. And I compare her to Montgomery Clift's acting. You know, there's a wonderful line that James Cagney gave advice to young actors, and the thing is, never let them catch you at it. And the significance of that is, if they know you're acting, then it's bad.
Yeah. Yep.
It's when you just think it's, well, it's effortless and it's, this is the way the character is. Peg has that quality. You never catch her at it.
Yeah, yeah. Someone I know in the news business, his advice to young reporters is don't hit folks over the head with it.
Yeah, he's quite right about that, too.
Yeah.
Or it's what I've always said about the art of singing. Don't get in the way of the song.
Right.
And it's just more a matter... I've done a lot of singing, and I'm always in the position of trying to get out of my own way, if you know what I mean.
Oh.
Just let it happen. Don't try to make it happen. And it's very, very hard to get yourself at that mental fix. Sinatra was a genius at it.
Yeah. He was a very powerful storyteller in song.
Yep, absolutely.
How did he develop his ability to hold us with his storytelling in song?
Well, you could give a million theories on it. And everybody goes into how he learned a phrase from Tommy Dorsey. Or as one really stupid remark I read said, you learned to breathe from Tommy Dorsey. No, you learn to breathe when the doctor holds you up by your heels and gives you a whack. But he learned a lot about phrasing from Tommy Dorsey, which is one of Dorsey's tricks was at the end of a musical phrase, like the end of the release of a song, he would hold a breath and slide right into the beginning of the next eight bars. And Sinatra learned that trick. But I saw an interview with him on television. Not too well, after he died, they ran an interview he'd done with, I think, with Larry King, and he said he never formally studied acting, and yet he became a very powerful actor. He was a prodigiously intelligent man. And when I was a kid, when I was growing up, a young fan of his, I would read these newspaper stories about one guy I remember to this day said that he sings as if, he said it sarcastically. He sings these songs as if he believed them. That's right. That's exactly the trick. And there's a thing you get into in acting, the so-called method acting. If you've got to cry in a scene, think of something in your childhood that made you cry or something you're terribly sad in your own life. Actors do this all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I have actually had a situation where I wrote a song. I wrote it for a kid I knew who was going off to Vietnam. I wrote it about him. And when I came to record it, I kept thinking, fortunately, he survived it all. But I kept thinking of that moment when he was in, you know, when I wrote the song. And in thinking about it and recording it, I actually began to cry. And I had to redo it, because that won't do. But there's all kinds of things that actors do, and I think singers do it too, where you get in touch with that emotion in yourself, and it will convey itself in the sound.
How do singers manage to just have the right amount of emotion, because you don't want to be crying?
Exactly. That this is really that it is walking a kind of a tightrope. The same thing goes into writing lyrics, by the way. If they're too emotional, they get banal and they slip into bathos. And the trick is to take the emotion right to the edge and not step over that line. And that isn't easy.
Mm-hmm.
And good people, like Yip Harbor, could do it. He could really, you know, Over the Rainbow is just a masterpiece lyric. I wanted to tell the man who called it, when I talked about talking about Howard Dietz, when he wrote That's Entertainment, the first release on that song goes, it could be a play simply teeming with sex, a gay divorcee who's pursuing her ex. It could be Oedipus Rex, where a man kills his father and causes a lot of bother. That's an astounding use of the English language. And the next release, he said it could be something on a screen, some great Shakespearean scene where a ghost and a prince meet and everybody ends in mincemeat. I mean, this is astounding technical command of the English language. And that Dietz blew me away.
By the way, what was that song that you wrote for the young man?
It's an album that isn't even out in this country. It came out in Canada.
Oh.
It was called All We Have Is Now.
Hmm.
I'll send you a copy of it if you like. If I can find it, I'll make you a tape of it.
That would be fabulous.
Yeah, I'll see if I can find that thing. It's an old album of mine done about 30 years ago.
Back to Frank Sinatra. How did he go from the big band scene and Tommy Dorsey to a more intimate musical statement to what you say were really chamber recordings?
Well, in the case of some of those things for Columbia Records, they literally were chamber recordings because he used a string quartet.
Mm-hmm.
in the rhythm section. And he had this, well, first of all, he started that sort of sound. I'm going to pick up that other phone so it doesn't bother us.
Okay, I will reintroduce you while you do
okay,
that.
Okay, all right.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Our guest this afternoon, writer, singer, lyricist Gene Lees. He's the author of several books on jazz and American popular music and its origins. He's the publisher of Gene Lees' Jazz Letter. Gene Lees recently revised his classic book, Singers and the Song. The new title is Singers and the Song 2. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. If you'd like to join the conversation, comments and questions are welcome in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else you're listening, call us toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. Back to Gene Lees.
Now, the question you asked me is, how does Sinatra make that transition?
Yeah.
Well, part of it had to do with Tommy Dorsey himself. Tommy Dorsey began to see the value of the singers he had, and he began to feature them in a way more than other band leaders had in the past. At the same time, there was a whole evolution going on in arranging and orchestrating. The guys who wrote for those big bands all had, most of them had anyway, extremely capable classical music training. And Axel Stordahl, and Paul Weston were both arrangers for that Dorsey band, and Axel Stordahl wrote some arrangements. Tommy had a string section, and he wrote four arrangements for Sinatra with that band using strings, and then Sinatra recorded them separately on Bluebird. They were The Night We Called It a Day, The Song Is You, The Lamplighter Serenade, and I forget what the other one was. And he did these as two singles separately on the Bluebird label, and they took off like gangbusters. I remember having them in high school. And this was a conveying of the meaning of a lyric like I had never heard before in my life. And here was I in Canada, and Julius LaRosa in Brooklyn, both listening to the same things and getting knocked on our can over what this guy could convey emotionally. And when he left Dorsey, Axel Stordahl went with him, and wrote all of those early Columbia records using wonderful string sections. And the music began to move more and more and more toward classical music. And an era of arrangers, aside from the singers, an era of brilliant, brilliant arrangers came up, like Billy May and Nelson Riddle and Robert Farnon in England and Marion Evans in this country. As a matter of fact, my next book's on that subject, The Great Arrangers. Mm. And all of the scope of classical orchestration began to come into American popular music. So not only do we have a generation of fantastically good singers, and Frank was the best of them, but he wasn't the only one. And the best singer I've ever heard in my life, again, like I feel about Howard Dietz, the best singer I've ever heard in my life in any idiom is Marilyn May. They have Peter Matz, arrangers like Peter Matz, who are writing these marvelous string and brass orchestrations. And by the 1950s and 60s, the whole level of American popular music was rising, 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 rising. It was developing almost into classical music. And then along came Elvis Presley and the Beatles and all of these people were just thrown on the scrap heap. And because, you know, rock and roll could make a lot more money for the record company. So this stuff all began to get phased out. And it's gone. The era's over. It can never come back again. It won't. But Sinatra, he taught everybody. Everybody learned from him. Everybody.
Why don't we hear him?
Good.
A Johnny Mercer lyric.
And one of Mercer's masterpieces.
Music by Harold Arlen, One for My Baby.
It's 2:45. There's no one in the place except you and me. So set 'em up, Joe. I got a little story you ought to know. We're drinking, my friend, to the end of a brief episode. make it one for my baby, and one more for the road. I know the routine, put another nickel in the machine. Feel kind of bad. Can't you make the music easy and sad? I could tell you a lot, but you gotta be true to your code. Just make it one for my baby.
Frank Sinatra, One for My Baby. That was recorded in Australia in 1959.
I have that record. He made several versions of it. The best performance of it he ever did that I ever saw was on one of his television specials, which I saw right after he died. He makes some mistakes in that lyric, as Frank was prone to do. There's a brilliant line in there. He says, could tell you a lot, but that's not in a gentleman's code. That's what the original line reads.
Mm.
And that was Mercer at his best. It's a wonderful song in the sense that it has got the condensation of a play. You've got a guy sitting there in the early stages of sentimental drinking,
and
he's getting more self-pitying as the time goes on. Then he gets aggressive. And you may not know it, but buddy, I'm a kind of poet, and I've got a lot of things to say. And then at the end, he says, reaching that absolute depth of despair at the end of the song, he says, well, that's how it goes, and Joe, I know you're getting anxious to close, so thanks for the cheer. Hope you didn't mind my bending your ear.
Yeah.
And it's the whole progression of an evening condensed into one song. It's an amazing piece of work.
The
Mercy Request is my God.
Yeah. Am I to understand that you're going to be doing a book on
Mercy? I'm doing it now. I'm working on it. As a matter of fact, I just got off the phone an hour ago with Georgia State University. I'm flying over to there, from California. I'm flying to Georgia in 3 weeks to go through all Mercer's papers. And he wrote an autobiography that he never completed, and after he died, his wife asked me to edit it, and I have that, and I'm working very closely with his daughter, who's the one who really wanted me to do the book. But John and I were very good friends.
Yeah.
And I'm so thrilled about this book. I'm so excited about the material that's there. This complex melancholy, as you know, the repertoire. And the essential failure of the book is inevitably bound to be today it's not going to be read by anybody who isn't already interested. And secondly, it won't be understood by anybody who doesn't know the material. So in terms of educating a public, particularly a young public today that has never heard this material, a little bit is beginning to be heard because of what Tony Bennett is doing. And there is some discovery of the era going on. But the classic era of American song from like about the 20s through to the middle to late 50s, there's no radio stations to play it, for example.
Yeah.
We have one little university jazz station here in California, south of San Francisco. I mean, it's barren. And the one jazz station in Washington, D.C. just dumped the policy of jazz. And so the great mass of educational material, NPR is the only thing we have.
Well, we have a companion FM station on Saturday night. It's Jazz All Night.
Uh-huh.
So, and also on the AM side, we carry...
You're on the AM side?
Yeah, we carry Fresh Air with Terry Gross. And she's,
oh, yeah, sure.
She's done a lot of great work interviewing folks like Susanna McCorkle.
Yeah.
Contemporary singer-songwriters.
Yeah.
Bobby Short.
Yeah.
Lots of wonderful folks.
Mm-hmm.
And she does concerts with them.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about your collaboration with Antonio Carlos Jobim before we run out of time here.
Yeah. I met him in Rio in 1962. I was down there on a cultural exchange tour for the State Department, but one of the reasons I went is because I wanted to meet him. I'd already heard some of his stuff. Dizzy Gillespie turned me on to his stuff. And when I was in Rio, I did some of the first of those. I did the very first translations of his things ever done, such as Quiet Nights, which is a fairly accurate translation to the extent that any translation can ever be accurate. I wrote, and then he came up to New York, and we did a lot of songs together. I think we wrote about a. I'm in the middle of recording an album of them, as a matter of fact. I think we did 12 of them.
What are the challenges of translating a tune from one language to another? How do you go about it?
The only thing you can do, and I worked a lot with Charles Aznavour on his Broadway show, you take the whole concept of the lyric, break it down, and reconstruct it in the other language. You can never do direct translation. I think if you're going to play that Ella Fitzgerald Desafinado, that has a wrong lyric on it.
Oh, okay.
It has a lyric by John Hendricks on it, if that's the version I think it is, and Jobim insisted they withdraw it. Sinatra recorded it, but it never came out, and I know why it didn't come out, because I heard the tape of it. He and Jobim both sound loaded. I guess it must have been late in the session, and it got a little wet. That never came out. There's only a very few correct versions of that lyric have ever been done.
Well, see, we don't know all these things.
No, well, why should you?
It's just a storehouse.
It's not inside stuff that I don't think is of any great interest to anybody but us in the business.
Hmm. Well, what do you think about Sarah Vaughan singing Quiet Nights of Quiet Stars?
Well, Sarah was the first one who ever sang the lyric correctly.
Oh, okay.
And then Sinatra sang it to me. There's about four versions of that song that I really like. Sarah's, but Sinatra's, Julius LaRose's, and Marilyn May's. Some of the others just don't blow me away.
Yeah. Well, we'll go out with Sarah Vaughan here in just a second.
Oh, my dear late friend.
Yeah. Wonderful.
She did a lot of my stuff.
Yeah?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I was over at her house one day. I was working on a project with her, and I says, hey, by the way, Sass, you've done a lot of my things. She says, oh, I thought you'd never mention it.
Before we hear that, I want to ask you one more question. In the chapter you devote to Jobim, you say he was more than a talent, and I'm paraphrasing here, he had a genius.
I think he did.
What was that genius?
The genius was there's a phenomenon in some people that is above and beyond skill. Skill is an acquirable quality. It's a learnable thing. You go to university, you go to school, and you acquire the tools. But the final thing is some sort of mysterious neurological phenomenon of people whose sense of one note to come after the other is so uncannily right that it transcends skill and it amounts to the level of genius. Jobim had this, and what's more, he could take some comparatively ordinary musical materials, comparatively conventional materials, and do something so original with it. That it just left you amazed, and he wrote some of the most sinuously beautiful melodies of the 20th century.
They are
a very great composer.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon. We could go on all afternoon. I think.
If you ever want to do it again, I'm right here.
Okay,
I would love it, and I've thoroughly enjoyed it.
You'll be hearing from me.
Thank you, Celeste.
Thank you,
and I'll be in touch with you too.
Okay, Gene Lee's our guest this afternoon. Look for his book, Singers and the Song. It's out now in a new edition. The new title, Singers and the Song 2. The publisher is Oxford. And here now, Sarah Vaughan, singing Corcovado.
Quiet nights of quiet stars, quiet chords from your guitar floating on the silence that surrounds us. Quiet thoughts and quiet dreams, quiet walks by quiet streams, and the window that looks out on the mountains and the sea. Ooh, how lovely. This is where I want to be, here with you so close to me, until the final flicker of life's ember. I, who was lost and lonely, believing life was only a bitter, tragic joke, have found with you the meaning of existence, oh my love.
Quiet Nights of Quiet Stars, Sarah Vaughan.